Thank you, Mr. Innes. I'm Jamie Gardner, and we're delighted to have this opportunity, and indeed we're delighted to be playing host to you in this meeting. I'm going to ask Ben Rice to begin by giving a quick run through the outline of our submission, and then I'll make some remarks as well.
Thanks, Jamie, and thanks, Commissioner. We do appreciate the opportunity today to address this important inquiry, and we'd like to start by just quickly revisiting the main arguments included in the Commission's original written submission to this inquiry. And the Victorian Commission, in its submission, outlined the developments in Victoria for which its 1998 Same-Sex Relationships in the Law report and inquiry provided a catalyst. And this was regarding the improved recognition of same-sex relationships and removal from the Victorian statute of provisions which discriminated against same-sex relationships in a fairly blatant way. This was primarily achieved through the introduction of the gender-neutral term domestic partnership, as I know has been discussed today, where previously legislation referred to, again in the Victorian context, the gender-sensitive term spouse, and in some cases, well, many cases, de facto couple. As the Commission's submission also pointed out, by simply amending Victorian legislation in this way to remove discrimination against same-sex couples, this didn't provide quite the fillip required to remove discrimination against same-sex couples in all forms and to all extents, including attitudinal discrimination, of course. And the Victorian submission draws out some of the remaining areas where the potential for discrimination remains. And two of the examples provided in the Victorian Commission's report relate to the areas of will and intestacy for same-sex couples. And connected to these issues are the evidentiary problems inherent in the need to establish that a domestic partnership under the revised or the new definition exists. And this is a challenge exacerbated by the lack of a mechanism for the formal recognition of same-sex couples and the relationship between same-sex couples. And in the case of the Victorian Administration and Probate Act, which is one of the examples raised, the minimum eligibility period for establishing that a domestic partnership exists, and the period in that case is 2 years, places quite a stricture on establishing that a same-sex relationship exists and that it has the legal standing commensurate with a married couple. However, the submission that we provided also points out that these outstanding shortcomings don't really detract from the overall progress towards the full recognition of same-sex relationships in Victoria and the reflection of this in the Victorian law. Furthermore, recognising same-sex relationships in legislation, and more to the point in the Victorian context, simply removing discriminatory provisions as a standalone measure, when we consider the broader ambit and enjoyment of rights, doesn't essentially place same-sex couples on par with their married and de facto equivalents. And this is the basis for the Victorian Commission's support for an open and accessible mechanism for recognising and affirming the character and permanence of same-sex relationships, akin to the status attributed to the legal partnership created by a marriage. And the particular model endorsed by the Commission in its submission is one based on recognition and registration of civil unions of same-sex couples. The Commission submission then seeks to demonstrate that in the federal arena, there hasn't been a similar zest for improving the human rights of members of same-sex relationships, and this is despite clear guidance on the obligation Australia and its constituent states and territories has to remove discrimination against members of the gay and lesbian community in all forms, including in legislation, but also more broadly. The submission points to the refusal by the Commonwealth to act on the referral of powers from the states in relation to property adjustments, and I understand that's been discussed today, and the lack of support, and notably the lack of the attendant services that the federal court can offer by way of mediation services and counselling services that exists under the Federal Law Act, when we compare this to the more antiquated provisions of the Victorian Property Law Act. underlining the comparative lack of recognition of the status and human rights of same-sex couples in the federal arena is the lack of a comprehensive anti-discrimination act that would provide similar protection to gay, lesbian, bisexual and intersex Australians as exists in relation to the race, disability, sex and age anti-discrimination statutes. And this essentially is quite an abbreviated recount of the Commission's submission to Heriot's inquiry.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. I just wanted to add and amplify that perhaps a moment, and then perhaps it might be most profitable if we deal with the questions.
That would be great if you're happy to do that, yeah.
Given that we gave a long and closely worded submission.
Yeah.
But it does seem to me that there are several aspects. As Ben has already said, and as our submission points out, there have been very significant advances in Victorian law since the Commission's 1998 report that Ben had and has on the table here, and in particular the reforms of 2001 that you mentioned before when the lobby was speaking, where the recognition of same-sex and opposite-sex relationships under the rubric of domestic partnership made significant changes to the law. But as Ben, as our submission points out, as Ben points out, there is no registration scheme, there is no civil union scheme, and so, as quite a few of today's witnesses have pointed out, there are burdens of evidence and the presumption is essentially against, whereas in the heterosexual case the presumption is in favour of recognition. The Commission's submission was partly structured around using the examples of what we have learnt in Victoria to both suggest things that Victoria still needs to work on to improve and build on the progress of the last 6 years, 7 years, as also as a model for what the Commonwealth could have and other states. Some have and some have not. I think at this stage only South Australia is totally lagging behind. So that there are a variety of very technical matters, some of which you canvassed in greater detail than I could manage with the lobby about aspects of federal legislation. But the sorts of issues that we mentioned in our submission around the problems, even of the advances of the 2001 domestic partnership legislation, recognition but without registration, are things like what Ben mentioned about the Administration and Probate Act, and all of those issues, problems of proof, plus, of course, I think we only mentioned it very briefly in the submission, the matters raised by the first three sets of witnesses around the recognition of parenthood and family. But that was well canvassed then, and we're not going to say anything more about that at this stage. So we see the Victorian laws over the last few years of having made significant progress, but they've also revealed problems. And perhaps the major problem is the one that the Commission anticipated in its 1998 report, which is that there needs to be a way of getting a certificate registration, what's called civil union in some places, and there perhaps may or may not be differences. As you heard yesterday in Tasmania, they have a registration scheme which could also be classified as a civil union scheme. And I know that the Tasmanians recommended to you that you should propagate the Tasmanian system around the whole country.
They did.
And clearly that would be a great progress towards equality. And the one general point I want to make before we get on to your questions is one of the underlying things around, one of the reasons, not just because it's right, one of the reasons that equality is so important. The Commission had a meeting recently with Rob Moody, the CEO of Vic Health, Health Promotion Foundation, and he said to us that, talked about the relationship between discrimination and health, and made it very clear that he regarded an Equal Opportunity Commission as being a health promotion authority in itself, because discrimination leads to ill health in a whole range of ways that mean that every step towards equality is also a step towards better health, not only in the at the fairly personal level of feeling less besieged by society. It was very clear from the experience of the parents who spoke earlier that people do feel besieged in a heterosexist or homophobic society, but the effects of discrimination on health start at school. They lower self-esteem, they can lead into depression or low-level depression, they can lead as Lee Matthews pointed out, to a restricted notion of what careers might be available to one, and they can lead, quite specifically, Rob Moody explained to us, that into physiological effects in the arteries and the internal systems in a range of ways, and so that the specifics around homophobia, generally, the discrimination imminent in society, is a factor for ill health. And there's also research that has been done both here and in relation to the Law Reform Commission's inquiry on parenting and elsewhere, which shows that a critical element in the promotion of better health and in the elimination of discrimination is the recognition of couplehood. There was a recent paper by the in the official journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics about the benefits of or about the effect of laws in the United States on laws relating to marriage, civil union and domestic partnership on health, and which concluded clearly that the currently discriminatory laws adversely affected people's health, and that the full recognition of same-sex couples as equal and as equal participants in our society is a step toward better health. Mm. So that's in addition to the fundamental rule of law questions about human rights and equality, it is also a matter for public health as well.
Yes.
I think that's as much as I should say now, and look forward to the questions that you may have for us.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Ben. I mean, I think that's a valid and useful point that you make in terms of health issues, and in terms of the Tasmanians wanting us to propagate their system around the country. We can maybe recommend that. I don't know that we can actually do the propagation. That's in others' hands. However, you note, talking about your report, that that it's found on the basis of submissions received and your research that the most appropriate form of relationship recognition involves a two-tiered approach, the extension of legislative definitions of de facto spouse to include same-sex couples, and secondly the establishment of a relationship register as the Tasmanian government has done. Why do you believe a two-tiered approach is important, and what would be the disadvantages, in your opinion, of introducing one without the other?
Well, the reason for a two-tiered approach is, in a way, the reason that Australian law developed to recognise, even in law, the de facto relationships that people have. People don't always get round to doing the formal stuff, even if they intend to, and it is important that the law should acknowledge the reality of people's lives, even if they've been slack with the paperwork, so that the ability to have a safety net to recognise that if people fall within the legislative category of domestic partnership, as we have here, then they're entitled to certain rights and considerations, protects them even if they haven't got around to doing the paperwork, or in the case of same-sex couples, if the paperwork is not available to them. So that's necessary anyway. But the reason that the Commission proposed in 1998, and certainly even more emphatically proposes now, that a registration system, a system which in some ways gives people the piece of paper, is that with being on a register as a couple, having a certificate akin to a marriage certificate, I guess, which says yes, these two people are a couple and benefit from the laws relating to couples, means that you don't have to prove your relationship over and over again. And we heard some of the examples where the anxiety and the distress and the difficulties of proving relationships over and over again, at least with less sympathetic clerks, even if often friends and workplace colleagues are fine, is one that actually does deter people. We heard, for example, of a couple earlier today who were discouraged and prevented, in effect, from buying a house together because of the difficulty in the case of the federal law. So having the capacity to have one process agreed, registered, and then you've got your certificate. So when you front up to the emergency ward and say, no, that's my partner, and they say, really? And you say, yeah, look, I've got a certificate. Then you're in. And there are probably, you know, there are many other circumstances in which that would be a benefit.
Sure.
So the two things are necessary. The system of registration and certificate just makes life so much easier for people. The safety net picks up those who haven't got round to it one way or the other.
Do you think there are disadvantages, particularly disadvantages in introducing one without the other? I mean, apart from the obvious one, which is the contrary to what you've just said of not having that safety net. Are there particular issues, though, in introducing one without the other?
I think they are just the ones you've identified. After all, until the High Court began to recognise de facto marriages for many purposes in the, what was it, 1970s or 1980s, then that was the situation for heterosexual couples.
Yeah.
You had a certificate or you had nothing. So having the capacity to have a registered relationship, whether it's called a marriage or a civil union or a registered partnership, having that capacity is a big step forward. For that matter, having, as we have for same-sex couples in Victoria, a safety net is also a big step forward, but neither of them is adequate by itself.
Sure. Okay. You note that following the report, there were further amendments to the Equal Opportunity Act through the Equal Opportunity, Gender Identity and Sexual Orientation Act in 2000, introducing the attributes of sexual orientation and gender identity. In what practical ways did this affect people in same-sex relationships in Victoria?
The adding of those two attributes, or in the case of sexual orientation, the renaming of the 1995 attribute of lawful sexual activity as sexual orientation, did not have a specific effect for couples. It was more about according the general non-discrimination provisions of the Act a meaning that was more dignified and accorded more with how people saw themselves, rather than the arcane and coy lawful sexual activity. So that, so far as couples are concerned, there was, I think, no specific advantage, but so far as the respect that the Act showed for lesbians and gay men in general, sexual orientation was greatly preferable. So far as amending the Equal Opportunity Act is concerned, the major change was when marital status was expanded in 2001 to include the status of being in a domestic partnership, and therefore including couples, so that in the provision of goods and services and in employment and in education and in accommodation, municipal councils and the transfer of land. Have I misgot all the areas?
Sport.
And sport. In all of those areas, in 2001, being in a same-sex couple became an attribute protected by the Act in all of those areas. And that was, I think, the major reform of those 2 years in relation to the Act itself.
Moving on to Relationships Act amendments, the 2001 legislation. And you say that it amended 57 acts in total, and you note that the definitions of domestic partner, two definitions were adopted. Why were the two definitions necessary?
Well, the government, I understand, took the view that the two definitions, that there was a distinction, I believe, in the government's assessment when what they described as property was involved, where they required, considered it appropriate to have greater certainty in some senses. Obviously, the decisions about government policy are outside our direct involvement.
Sure.
And very strangely, in one might say, the original distinction in the bill as originally introduced towards the end of 2000, the original distinction between the two definitions, and the main distinction was between whether or not the parties lived under the one roof or not, was significantly blurred by amendments introduced during the second reading phase, in which the status of living under the one roof became only one of the considerations to be considered in assessing whether or not a domestic partnership existed. So the answer is we're not qualified to say what the government's intention was, except by reading the Act, the words of the Act, but one can speculate that there were issues relating to acceptance of the idea, requisite degrees of certainty perhaps, or clarity or simplicity of definition, but I'm not entirely sure, I don't believe it's ever been tested in court, I'm not entirely sure that the distinction, that the two definitions, in fact I'm pretty sure they didn't, the two definitions are, I would suspect, now overlapping where they were not originally. So I don't think that's a full answer to your question, but I think it's as good as I could do. Ben might be able to add something to that.
Okay. Well, my next question might be difficult then, which is, would you suggest a similar approach be adopted in federal law? You know, do you think that the term domestic partner would provide equality if adopted at a federal level?
I think it would. I think that domestic partner, defined in a way that gave priority in the, I haven't got them in front of me, but in the whatever
seven or eight
points in the matters that the court may take into account but are not exclusive, blah, blah, blah. In my view, and I think in the Commission's view, those are a way of describing and allowing a tribunal of fact, whether it's a court or, for that matter, the Commission, to form the view as to whether, in fact, there is, as asserted, a domestic partnership. And perhaps the most important of those, I would suggest, is the criterion of mutual commitment to a shared life. Now, as you'll be aware, those that list of criteria comes ultimately from a New South Wales judgment of, I'm going to forget the name of the case, but anyway, that's easily traced.
I know the case.
And they were the indicia of a de facto marriage.
Yep.
Ours omit the criterion about the shared washing up. Apart from that, they're much the same criteria. And they're the same criteria as written into federal legislation. It seems to me that I would suggest that only one definition really be needed. The question is one of fact, is this couple in fact a couple?
Yep.
And those indicia seem to be sensible. And that's for the safety net definition. And obviously for the possibility of creating a relationship, whether it's called a civil union or whatever, then the only important criteria are mutual consent and eligibility within the questions of age and capacity and so on.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Do you think these criteria are more suitable than those used to establish an interdependency relationship in some areas of federal law?
I think they are. I haven't perhaps given a close attention to that to that distinction. The I think, as Gerard and Ali from the lobby pointed out, the decision of the federal government to create a new category of relationship under the rubric of interdependency amounts to a separate and even, but not even quite equal, a sort of an apartheid type of definition that emphasises the non-personal aspects. The point about couplehood is that it's about emotional commitment. The point about interdependency is it's just about money. If I don't mischaracterise it, and I haven't got it in front of me, would that be right?
If we got it more than money, isn't it? It's, although I understand the distinction you're drawing, but
I don't think we. I don't think we've got that. I realise that the interdependency can be interpreted to include the emotional interdependency, but on my reading of that a while ago, it seemed to me that that the adding of a new category rather than simply incorporating of same-sex couples into the existing categories was a way, was a noli me tangere, a sort of keep at arm's length thing. And it was focused on the material conditions of the relationship, I think, rather than the emotional commitment of the couple.
No, I understand your point. Okay, can I turn to the Victorian Parliamentary Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee, their inquiry?
Yep.
You say that report identified two acts which still discriminate against same-sex couples, the Anzac Day Act 1958 and the Credit Act 1984. Can you tell us what the Relationships Act were unable to eliminate discrimination in those areas? Is there a...
I think it would probably be more to the point that the Relationships Acts, because that statute law amendment process in 2001 went through the statute book, I suspect that these two just might have been missed out.
Okay.
Now the Credit Act may have been left out because it's essentially an obsolete act.
Yes, because of the Uniform Credit Card.
Yes. Yeah. So I think it may be that it was missed out simply because it was thought it probably no longer applied to anyone.
Okay.
I can't be certain about that. I'm fairly sure that the Anzac Day Act was just missed, but I may not be right about that. The interesting thing about the Anzac Day Act is that, a related matter that I don't think that SARC picked up is that... I'm just having a quick glance to remind myself. We didn't say anything more. What, in fact, at the time we were drafting this submission, Anzac Day fell while we were doing it on it.
Right.
And I noted with interest that in the state government advertisements about free transport for ex-service people and their spouses, it was in fact expressed in terms of having, is it the gold card, and essentially that free public transport was given in the immediate vicinity of Anzac Day, I can't remember the 2 or 3 days around Anzac Day, to ex-service people in uniform and or their partners with the gold card.
Right.
And in a sense, although I don't think we ended up referring to it expressly, the reliance of Victorian benefits on a discriminatory Commonwealth eligibility matter is actually something which we could have mentioned, and we'll no doubt put up. And so I do mention it to you now, that that eligibility, my understanding is that if anyone had actually got in touch with whichever ministry handles those things, they would have been given some sort of dispensation, but I don't know whether anyone actually did do so.
It's a
problem of referred discrimination, which I think that wasn't picked up earlier on.
Okay. You also note that SARC recommended that Section 69 of the Equal Opportunity Act be repealed because it's a general exemption for discrimination where the conduct's necessary to comply with or is authorised by an act or enactment. Effectively giving it gives all laws priority over the provisions of the Equal Opportunity Act. Can you give an example of where Section 69 has been used to justify discrimination against same-sex couples?
Well, I guess if someone were to take a complaint in relation to treatment under the Credit Act 1984 or the Anzac Day Act to the Commission,
that'd be the only
if that discrimination were mandated by the legislation, then Section 69 would mean they were we would have to decline as misconceived.
You'd have to think they'd be the only areas if SARC has
I guess it would be appropriate to say that there is some legislation was not dealt with in the Relationships Acts of 2001 and therefore still overrules the Equal Opportunity Act, and those are the matters being the subject of a major inquiry by the Victorian Law Reform Commission. And I think we did mention somewhere in this submission that we weren't going to talk about those because there's an existing process. That Law Reform Commission is going to deal with the Adoption Act, the Infertility Treatment Act, and related legislation, including the things around birth certificates and so on that were mentioned. And so at the moment, those matters are subject of a Law Reform Commission inquiry, which is no doubt going to report, I would hope, within the next 2 or 3 months, and we will then see what they recommend and what the government proposes to do with those. So we didn't address them particularly. So Section 69 would certainly still apply to, for instance, prevent same-sex couples being recognised under the Adoption Act and so on.
Okay. If you could help us by making us aware when that Law Reform Commission report comes out, because we may not pick up on that, and if it's prior to our report, it might be helpful. If it's likely in the next few months, that would be great.
Yep, we'll do that.
Thank you. Can I just come in the last couple of minutes to the Victorian Human Rights Charter? Your submission comments that the Attorney General introduced a bill in May, which is the charter, sort of detail its the way that it operates, you say that the charter will provide significant protection in respect of future legislative reforms for same-sex couples, government actions and policies affecting their rights and lives in Victoria. In what areas of law do you think this charter will have most impact for same-sex couples?
That's a very speculative question. The charter comes into force, as you know, let me backtrack. The charter became law with the royal assent on the 25th of July, and it comes into force on the 1st of January.
Sure.
So that from the 1st of January, every piece of legislation that is brought through the government, or for that matter other processes, to Parliament.
Yep. I understand the schema of
yep.
that.
Yeah. So the question, the human rights question around equality, will have to be addressed in the development, for example, of responses to the Law Reform Commission's report when it comes out, because I'm sure that drafting and process will be subject to the charter. Mm. So that's one example. As to, I don't know whether Ben can think of any others specifically.
I mean, part of what I'm trying to find out is if there are any rights that will be protected under the charter that wouldn't have been protected under the Relationships Act amendments of 2001. That's sort of where I'm trying to go to an extent.
Well, I suppose that one would say that one thing that charter scrutiny might lead people to a view that, start that one again, scrutiny under the charter might well lead people to the conclusion that some aspects of the Relationships Act reforms of 2001 didn't go far enough, and in our submission we've highlighted some of those in relation to the Administration and Probate Act, and for that matter in relation to the Property Law Act, which actually reminds me that there is an issue around the Property Law Act that I wanted to mention, which is that Part 9 of the Property Law Act deals with property division between domestic partners on the breakdown of a relationship, and as you know, the Victorian Parliament enacted legislation to refer powers over both opposite sex and same-sex couples to the family, to the Commonwealth, to enable their property disputes to be dealt with under the Family Law Act. The Property Law Act, as I think we said here, has a very much more old-fashioned approach to the division, to dispute, to break up of relationship processes. It's undoubtedly better than nothing, and it's undoubtedly better than a sort of at-large attempt to invoke the court inequity. But the Property Law Act, we mentioned in the submission several of the differences where the Property Law Act, in a way, may not fully respect human rights because it provides a situation which is significantly less effective than the Family Law Act. Mm. We mentioned some. One of the ones that we didn't mention is that the Property Law Act provides for no confidentiality. Family Law Act matters have a blanket confidentiality provisions of the Family Law Act, so people can't be identified.
Mm.
And it's come to the Commission's notice, because it's been splashed across the front pages of the newspapers several times over the last few months, that where a same-sex couple are in dispute over the breakup of their relationship and the property, every salacious detail of their affidavits can be run in the newspapers. A completely an approach which clearly does not respect the inherent dignity of the parties, doesn't respect their privacy, and may well obviously the best way to deal with that is to for the Commonwealth to accept referral of power so that all such matters are dealt with under the Family Law Act. But meanwhile, the Property Law Act, insofar as it doesn't match the Family Law Act, might well be called into question under several aspects of the Charter, should such a matter be capable of arising. And I haven't turned my mind to whether in fact it could, but certainly as a matter of public discussion, I've no doubt it would.
Okay. Well, Jeremy, Ben, thank you very much for your both to you personally and on behalf of the Commission for the submission and the work that you've clearly done on it, and the questions that you've answered today have been very much appreciated. And can I just repeat the comments that I made at the beginning of the hearing this morning, appreciating the Commission's assistance with the organising of this hearing and availability of office facilities and this room. It's been very helpful contribution to the inquiry, so thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'd just like to add, if I may, acknowledgement of the work of Emma Turner, who is not here because she's on her honeymoon, who provided put an enormous amount of work into the detailed research for this submission. Well, so thank you very much to Emma, and thank you very much to the Commission for this opportunity.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.